Yeah, the Tavach. I may go a bit over time today, maybe a little longer than usual, but I would be nether pause at 1:15, and please feel comfortable to, if it's not convenient for you to leave, it's perfectly fine. I think I'll go, probably may go till about 1:30. Maybe we'll have pizza sadera. Usually it goes in the other direction. In considering what to talk about this week, and considering that we missed last week, when what I wanted to discuss I felt was very critical. So I'm going to allow myself to just be guided by where I am now, right now, inside, and the things that are going through my own mind, the things that I'm processing personally these days. And I think I'm going to allow myself to simply take that as the guiding point. So I am going to start with my own processing of the loss of Reb Chaim Knievsky. And I believe, Bezras Hashem, that we will get from there also to discuss our own inyan d'yoma right now, particularly regarding preparing for Pesach. Let's see. Okay. I had this chus. I'm going to talk from a personal angle. To talk about Reb Chaim Knievsky is like presumptuous. For two reasons. First of all, I didn't have a close personal relationship with him. I didn't have a personal relationship with him at all, for that matter. I had my few encounters with him, like thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people did. Some of them were quite profound. But altogether, the time that I spent conversing with him in all the different times probably adds up to about 15 minutes. Nevertheless, so that's one reason why it would be presumptuous. And number two, even if I would have had, it would be presumptuous for me to try to talk about somebody who's way beyond what a little mind like mine can comprehend. So what can I talk about? What I can talk about is how he affected me. That I could talk about. That I do know. That I know, right? So first of all, even though I said I didn't have a personal relationship with him, I actually did have a relationship with him, a pretty intense one, in the course of about 8 years, a daily relationship. How did that work? He didn't know about it. But I had this course of working on the Art School Yerushalmi. And the Art School Yerushalmi, working on the Art School Yerushalmi brought me into pretty much daily contact with Reb Chaim Knievsky's works, with Reb Chaim Knievsky's Sfarim. And this was something breathtaking. This was something breathtaking. We hear various anecdotes, stories about Moifsim, about various predictions, supernatural statements that he made, etc. As far as I'm concerned personally, the Mephis was the main Mephis was the Mephis of his life, the Mephis of his accomplishments in terms of his own learning, in terms of his ruchnius. And weiter, as far as I'm concerned, are all the stories that are told necessarily true? There's probably a lot of embellishment. I'm personally aware of embellishment in various instances that I know actually did not happen. There are also instances that I'm aware firsthand of the actual story, that it was true. There's no question that there definitely were amazing things going on. There's no question that many of those things were creative arms and legs. But weiter, as far as I'm concerned personally, being exposed to the moifus of his daily life and being exposed to the moifus of his accomplishments in learning, of his capacity in learning, and I'll elaborate on that in a practical way soon, bli neder, makes it obvious that, of course, you would see other manifestations of very special siyata d'shmaya, So it's like, even without having heard stories of Moifsin per se, it would be obvious to me that there probably were, that there were such stories. The Chafetz Chaim's son was famously asked, he said that we hear about many of the various, you know, Chassidish Rebbes, about miracles that they performed. Tzadik Goyzer v'Hashem Mekayim, right, the famous dictum, Tzadik Goyzer v'Hashem Mekayim, Tzadik decrees, Hashem carries it out. Well, tell me some about, tell me some of your father's stories, Chafetz Chaim's son said to him. This person said to the Chafetz Chaim's son, tell me some of your father's stories. So this person, the Chafetz Chaim's son answered, my father's moifes was the moifes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Goyzer v'Tzadik Mekayim. Right, that Hashem made a decree and the tzaddik fulfilled it. The manner in which my father lived the will of Hashem was the moifes of his life. It was done in a wondrous way, in a way that you might even call supernatural. But that was the moifes. The moifes was the ability, the levels at which HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes about tzaddik mekayim. Hashem gives the decree and the tzaddik was mekayim. Yerushalmi, as you may know, I'm not sure how much to lay this down. I hope that most of the women that are hearing us now are not involved in Gemara learning. I hope that all of them are not involved in Gemara learning. But I'll assume that to an extent you're familiar with Bavli versus Yerushalmi, just in a very basic way. Say that Yerushalmi is basically not standardly learned. I won't spend too much time explaining the ins and outs of it, but I'll just say this: you can have a person who's a very, very great Talmud Chacham and won't learn Yerushalmi, won't get to it. It's not at the center of regular Torah learning. However, when you're talking about the real greats, they got to Yerushalmi. And in order to really make Yerushalmi into a proper project, it's a difficult business. Yerushalmi is tough to learn. In certain ways, it's more difficult than our standard Gemara, which is due to a couple of factors. The difficulty of it is overstated, that I can also say from experience. But it's due to a number of factors. One of them, one is the difficult wording and phrasing of Yerushalmi. Another one is due to the fact that we simply don't have as many Sfarim on Yerushalmi. We don't have we have very, very limited Rishonim on Yerushalmi. Almost no Rishonim who have a running commentary on Yerushalmi. It's kind of like a treat when you find in a certain sugya that a Rishon addressed it in the course of his Perush on Bavli. So it's a challenge. And Reb Chaim has a running commentary on all of Yerushalmi where the clarity is astounding. And the attitude kind of when we were working was kind of like, obviously you have to be working with the classic Mefarshim, with the classic commentators, but at the end of the day, go with Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim makes everything work. Reb Chaim also, it was astounding how in his Perush, reflected, he was bringing together all the different approaches of the various Mefarshim who had preceded him. And part of the thing with Yerushalmi is that you can't stick with any one particular Mefarsh because you always run into a dead end. Yerushalmi is very, very cryptic and almost always run into a dead end. And Reb Chaim was kind of weaving together the various approaches and making the needed tweaks in order to just make a flowing, working Perush in each sugya. Now, maybe if you see this in Bavli, but here you realize that you're talking about Yerushalmi, which is, again, it's outside the standard, we're not talking about a person who dedicated his life to Yerushalmi. We're talking about a person who gave Yerushalmi its place in his structure of Bavli being at the center, Shas, Poiskim, Shulchan Aruch, and Yerushalmi also. He made a very big stress on this. When one of the big publication companies, Oizva Hadar, when they did a beautiful job on a new edition of the Gemara, Mamish a gorgeous job, which is one of the more popular editions of the Gemara that's used today in general, Oizva Hadar, And when they finished their Gemara, they made a very, very grand siyum. And what many of the Gedolei Ador came to show their appreciation of Reusvader's work. And Reb Chaim told them, Chaim Kanevsky told them, when you make your siyum on Yerushalmi, I'll come. They did. They also brought out an edition of Yerushalmi, which is also unprecedented in its beauty. In its usefulness, in how much it makes the learning experience much easier. He came then, but this was also characteristic of Reb Chaim's demand and approach. Don't sell yourself short. I want all of Klal Yisrael to be exposed to Yerushalmi, to be learning Yerushalmi, not instead of Bavli. No, of course, you're learning all of Bavli, and then you go to, but then you're incorporating Yerushalmi also. That was the idea. It wasn't like a person who came up with this new individual twist. I want people to be learning Yerushalmi, let's forget about Bavli. It was, no, I want you to be putting in all your efforts to your learning, but getting to the farthermost quarters. Now, this was also reflected in his Sfarim. His Sfarim, he wrote at length, in depth, about the farthermost corners of Torah that people wouldn't really come to, wouldn't really. And this was weiter. In Yerushalmi, we were often coming up against that, coming up against things that, who addressed this? Where can we find people who talk about it? Who's going to address the problems? And Reb Chaim in his farm, when we were dealing with the areas where Reb Chaim had written on, his farm like Nachal Eson, etc., it was simply to be pampered. Right, we knew everything was addressed. He talked about these like very, very remote areas of Torah that who touched, and you open Reb Chaim's farm and you feel like you're in like Eilu Metzias, like what the most basic sugyas that they're learning in the yeshivas with all the shitas, the rishayim, and all the kashas and the pilpulim. And this was a maifis. This was a maifis. It was breathtaking. You had to remind yourself every so often that I'm talking about somebody who's alive today. It was mind-boggling. It was out of proportion for Torah scholarship of our times. And this was a maifis. This was a maifis that I was exposed to for hours daily in the course of 8 years. The maifis, now what I mean, when I keep saying that it's a maifis, I actually mean something very literal here. It was very, very clear when studying his Sfarim, and famously, he was not a brilliant person. You are clearly seeing how when a person applied himself to Hashem's Torah, along with a life of uncompromising dedication to the word of Hashem, which perhaps we'll spend a couple of minutes on soon, how Hashem connected with him, and you saw the siyata d'shmaya pulsing in what he touched. You saw the expanded abilities. Right? This was not natural that a person should be able to get to such breadth and so comprehensive in the things that he wrote on. You really felt, if you were attuned, that you were exposed to something that was l'malo min derech hatev. And therefore, if you hear afterwards about a moifus story here, a moifus story there, okay, obviously, those are certain offshoots of the general solid picture, right, which was going on all the time. This is what we had. And again, a big part of his agenda, a big part of the messages that were conveyed, again, in the probably hundreds of thousands of people who have consulted with him over the years in each of those 15-second consultations that he was famous for, it was always that message of uncompromising demand of don't sell yourself short. You can do more than you think and do it. Just do it. Do more than you think. You've probably all heard already by now, I'm coming probably at the tail end of, and like I said, this is not a hespin, but just hearing the descriptions of what he called his choyves. Probably heard about that already. The systems that he had for making a yearly siyum on Shas, Bavli, and Yerushalmi, and all of Shulchan Aruch, and all of Rambam, and all of Tanakh, which was, right, that was not necessarily what he considered the main learning. These were things that he decided he had to get in every day. Right, he had his daily quota. He had to get in every day besides whatever other learning he did, besides what he considered the main learning, which was primarily, I understand, was primarily his writing of his farm. This was, again, something that he wasn't a rav, didn't have a kehila, wasn't a rosh yeshiva. He was a choshev avreich. He was a choshev kohel man his whole life, basically. Right? I don't think he had smicha. but what he provided for us was a role model. a role model already from his mid-50s. He was recognized as one of the Gdolei Ador, like, again, out of proportion with the rest of the picture. A role model that Klal Yisrael benefited from decades in terms of his lifestyle, in terms of the standards of learning that he introduced us to, and in terms of the demand, whether it came to Dikduk Halacha, whether it came to learning. And here I'll just throw in one story that goes around the family. I want to note that in general, this is just in general, and I hear amazing stories. I'm not talking about Reb Chaim now, I'm talking in general. When I hear a story that I feel, oh, this is really something, that's something contemporary, something that happened in our time, this is really something that carries a powerful message, and you hear it, where it happened, with the person involved, and then I try to go check them out. 60% of the time, the story turns out not to be true. It's an important point to stress. I want to stress that because this is in parentheses now. It's important to realize that many of the good things you hear, so many things just aren't true. That just makes the whole concept of avoiding machloikis and Kabbalah Loshon Hara into a much easier task than it might seem to be. Because even when we're talking about innocent stories, rumors, etc., that don't even carry any slandering, so many of the things that you hear just aren't true. Sometimes it's like unfortunate. Sometimes it's frustrating. I wish the story was true. But whatever the case is, this is a story that I'm still waiting for verification for. But I'm going to tell it anyways, because what I said was on the one hand. On the other hand, I heard B'Shem, a great person, who said, the stories that I tell are all true. I don't know if they happened or not, but they're all true. Now, that's actually a profound point, because the point of a story is its point. Well, I know we're talking about stories from a couple of days back. Do we really know if they happened or not? When a story carries, that's why we might say that a story should be used to illustrate a truth that you know is true. Don't really learn truths from stories. Don't. But okay, set that aside. That's a frustration I carry around with me, and every so often I express. But let's get back to our discussion. This is a story that's going around in our family with a relative, and I emailed him to find out if it's true, and I'm waiting for the response. But I'm going to tell it anyways, because it's a true story. I have a cousin who had means. And when my maternal grandfather was Nishter, some 20 years ago, so he came to Reb Chaim from Chutz Laaretz, came to Reb Chaim with a very beautiful proposition. He said to Reb Chaim, I would like you to recommend a Kohel man who you feel is worthy, who you feel is at the right level, and I will sponsor his learning Shas, not Shas Mishnayis, mind you, not Shas Mishnayis for the Yahrzeit, but learning all of Shas, Gemara, for as long as it takes. Now, Daf Yomi, which is relatively quick, takes 7 years. But as long as it takes, and I will sponsor his learning. He should dedicate himself to that. I will sponsor. It's a beautiful opportunity, especially for you to take a struggling Talmud Chacham and make such an offer to him. Something very beautiful. Reb Chaim's response was, I'm not going to recommend an Avreich, you do it yourself. So my cousin was like, I can't really do that. You can, do it anyways. And he was like, he said, it's a bigger schus for you, bigger schus for your grandfather. And at the end of the day, Reb Chaim refused to name. My cousin kept on trying to say, but you know, tachlis, just name somebody. But He refused. At the end of the day, he refused. He said, this is not something to hire somebody else to do. You do it yourself. Now,
did he do it himself?
What's that?
Did he do it himself?
First, I have to find out if the first part of the story happened. Then I have to find out. Then I have to find out about the continuation. But why do I say that this is clearly a true story? Because this was definitely characteristic of the approach that people who had experiences with Reb Chaim came away with. This was classic in terms of the approach. Now, this was true also when it came to Torah and mitzvahs, just to talk in very, very broad strokes about the attitude of uncompromising, no chokhmas, literal, what doesn't seem practical, you do anyways. And, you know, in Kelmda used to say, there's never a question of can you or can't you do something. The question is only should you or shouldn't you. If you should, whether you can or can't, shouldn't be relevant. Right? So that's what they used to say in Kelmda. So just the examples of it, about simple things. The three tefillahs a day were all done at the first possible moment. Mitzvahs were done as soon as they became relevant. Shacharis, Nesikin, Mincha Gedolah, as soon as the Zman hit. Myron Leiter, he made, as soon as the Zman hit, according to the most Machmir Zman of what Tzeis HaKachavim, meaning he went with the latest Zman of Tzeis HaKachavim, but immediately then, right? I shouldn't say the latest, the Chazanish Shita, about 40 minutes after Shkia, which is, okay, it's not necessarily like a story that you can tell about the Gadol HaDor, but I'm talking about in terms of characteristic of the approach. Many other instances of where things became relevant, if he would have waited a day or two, it would have been much more convenient to deal with it. But no, immediately, something becomes relevant, you deal with it immediately. Like the Mesiyas Yesharim says, mitzvah boli yotchal tach mitzena. The very fact that you are rushing to do the mitzvah adds so much more to its value, even if it really can wait. The fact that you're showing that I cherish it so much, that I want to do it now rather than tomorrow, even if it will be more convenient to do tomorrow, adds a lot more weight and value to the mitzvah itself. The meticulousness, the no chachma. This is one incident, but again, we talked about moifsim. I see in this a moifis, just in terms of the approach. Reb Chaim had a nephew-in-law whose name was Reb Chaim. So the stipler, I'm not going to try to keep this simple. The stipler was Reb Chaim's father. He had a son named Reb Chaim, and he had a grandson-in-law named Reb Chaim. It's common, happens, right? Now, the stipler's daughter, Rebbe Zimbarzin, the other Reb Chaim's mother-in-law, was by the stipler once, and she said, Reb Chaim's back has been bad lately. She was talking about her son-in-law. Okay? The stipler thought she was talking about her brother, his son, Reb Chaim Kanievsky. Okay? She was talking about Reb Chaim Kluft, and he thought she was talking about Reb Chaim Kanievsky. The stipler, also kind of characteristic of his own approach, got up immediately, went over to Reb Chaim's house. They didn't live far from each other. It was basically down the street. Knocked on the door. The stipler had his different remedies and different things that he would do. Came in and he told Reb Chaim, okay, lie down on the couch, face down. And he did what he did. And he smeared something on. He pressed, pushed, this, that. Now, you know, Reb Chaim was sitting in his house. Didn't know where this was hitting from, right? His father walked in, ordered him to lie down on the couch, face down, and he didn't, Reb Chaim didn't ask, what's this about? His father said to lie down on the couch. Now he has a Dvar Hashem telling him what Hashem wants from him right now is to be lying down on the couch and having his back pressed and smeared and whatever it is. Reb Chaim didn't ask, didn't know what it was about, didn't say a word. Lied down on the couch, got that treatment, the stipler was satisfied, left him with some instructions. He left. Not a question was asked. What was this about? As far as Reb Chaim was concerned, what this was about was his father told him to do something. He did it. Weiter. The point of the story is characteristic of the whole approach, the whole attitude of how you relate to Dvar Hashem. How did it end up playing out? I hope that the other Reb Chaim ended up getting his treatment. But again, I don't know the end of that story either. This was weiter the approach. I one time heard in a recording somebody asking him about making an amal ama. He was supposed to leave an amal ama unpainted, zecha l'korban, in your apartments. He said, what if you're in a rented apartment? They have to do it there too. So Reb Chaim said, yes. So this person said, what if the landlord isn't willing? So Reb Chaim said, isn't willing? He's a Rasha. You're asking me questions about Rishayim. He didn't say what the answer is or not, but it was just like the question is not relevant. We don't have Rishayim. The person doesn't want to have the Amal Amo. It's a Rasha. Now, are there other Shitas? I don't know. Perhaps, etc. I'm bringing out an attitude, an approach. This is the way he ran his life. So, to take it to the next level, We lost Reb Chaim. We lost Reb Chaim. The void is immense, and it's being felt in a very practical way in very many levels. But to come back to the point that Reb Chaim's dedication to his learning, his dedication to the Dvar Hashem, brought about supernatural levels and accomplishments in Atzlacha and learning, where, like I said before, you really sensed the Siyata Deshmaya when you were dealing with such breathtaking works like his Biron Yerushalmi, like his farm, like Nachal Eson, Derech Emunah. Right? You know what Derech Emunah is? Derech Emunah is a five-volume Mishneh-Berurah-like sefer on Zeroyim. Zeroyim, again, is an area of Torah where only the biggest Talmid HaChachamim really master. It's not in the standard course. Noshin, Nezikin, the other areas of Gemara. And he wrote a Mishneh Berurah like sefer on all of Rambam Hilchos Zeroyim. Mamish, the whole with the full Mishneh Berurah format. It's a mind-boggling works. Other such as far. You sensed the Siyata Deshmaya. You sensed that this was not human ability. That this was a person who was accomplishments were being expanded and accelerated by the fact that he was lived his whole life with such kedusha and tmimus, that the Siyata Deshmaya, that Hashem, the Shekhinah, was simply pumping, was simply pulsing in whatever he was doing. And therefore, yes, it is not a chiddush, it shouldn't be a chiddush, and we should expect, even without hearing the stories, that you would hear about amazing things going on around him. The day of his Levaya. So, okay, everybody knows about the traffic complications that were already being dealt with, and Baruch Hashem, it was very amazing the way it all played out. But just in terms of the personal experience, we wanted to be Moshe Nefesh to get there. Other people were even more Moshe. People went to camp out overnight in Bnei Brak. But we left a more normal, regular, it was probably the lower level of the Moshe Nefesh at that point. We left on a bus at 7 in the morning. The Levaya was at 12. I left on a bus at 7 in the morning. I knew what I was in for. We brought along, I went with my 12-year-old son. My 17-year-old had gone off with a group of guys at 1 in the morning to camp out wherever they would find him. But I went with my 12-year-old son, 7 in the morning. We brought along Sfarim and food for the whole day. We figured we're going to be there. We're not going to be trying to rush, figure out, beat the crowds, whatever it is. We're going early. We'll settle ourselves down. And I had in mind, I'm going to find a shul to sit down in. Very an idyllic day, right? We get there very early, find a shul to sit down in. We're going to sit and learn. We have our food with us. So the time comes. We came to Bnei Brak, and the shuls were packed. Right? The shuls were packed. We came to a shul which was kind of near the area where we would want to be for the Levaya. I also figured that out. We didn't want to be close to the center. We wanted to be further, far enough out. But came into this shul. The shul is packed. But all the different pieces of the experience were so profound. So first of all, the gabayim of the shul were busy putting out more benches and tables and all the different areas of the shul that were never used all the back rooms and all the hallways and the steps were lined with people sitting and learning. Then the gabayim kept on putting out mezainis and coffee and all kinds of things. But, I came in, all kinds of Beit Shemesh people there, all kinds of non-Beit Shemesh people there. But you know what was simply amazing? We sat down for a three-hour seder of learning. Jews from all around Eretz Yisrael, that was in that one shul. I imagine that was not the only shul. It was like that. It's so characteristic of Reb Chaim. Before his Levaya, Jews came from all around Eretz Yisrael, congregated together in those shuls, and you sat in the shul. 3 hours, people were just sitting and learning. What would Reb Chaim would have wanted more in terms of, taking mamish literally, Hashiva Yeshiva al Kivroi, even before he was interred? That itself was a very powerful experience. Okay, the Levaya, you've seen enough descriptions, maybe you also watched it. The rest of the day is certainly not something to talk about. They're trying to figure out how we were going to get ourselves home. But one thing that I'm trying to internalize, that this is the message I'm trying to bring home for myself and in my home, was that Reb Chaim really demonstrated for us how Shamayim Va'aretz are not to disconnected realms. How there is a spiritual dynamic, very profound, or potentially there in our world, in the Bria, which you can connect to by real intense dedication to be nidbak, to be dovek in the Shekhinah, to connect with the Shekhinah according to the means that the Shekhinah that Hashem provides for you. Whether through Torah learning, very meticulous and dedicated application to Ratzon Hashem. And that brings, that brings Shekhinah into your life. It binds you up with the Shekhinah, and you'll see the Shekhinah pulsing in your life. Will you see it on that level of Reb Chaim? Reb Chaim didn't see it on the level of Eliyahu HaNavi or Moshe Rabbeinu. But it's all the same system. It's all the same system. The Kuzari makes the point that when we talk about Moshe Rabbeinu going to Shamayim, not eating for and drinking for 40 days, something very supernatural, right? When you talk about Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah walking through that blazing furnace and coming out unscathed. So the Kuzari says, these are not stories of individuals. This is the story of what the neshama of a Jew is, of what the nefesh of a Jew is, brought to its maximum. But that infrastructure is what every one of us are. Now, there may be other conditions that may have to be in place in order to really allow the supernatural phenomena to manifest. But even when the conditions are not there, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have Nevuah today, but those same things are at work. You're connecting with the Shekhinah. Moshe Rabbeinu connected with the Shekhinah to an extent that he didn't have to eat for 40 days, right? And Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah connected with the Shekhinah in a way that enabled them to walk through a fire unscathed. Even if we're not going to actually see those things, we're part of that same system. We're connecting with the Shekhinah in the same way. And you also will see special Hashem involving himself in your life. If you're attuned to it, if you're aware of it. The famous grasshopper story. I imagine that by now everybody's heard the grasshopper story. Now I'll repeat it very briefly. If anyone didn't hear it, then I'll repeat it very briefly. Didn't hear the story. This is one of the stories that came from very authoritative sources. It's actually said at the Levaya by Rabbi Yitzchok Zilberstein, one of the Gedolei HaRabbanim today, Reb Chaim's brother-in-law, that when Reb Chaim was working, again, I said that he had his Sfarim touching the most remote corners of Torah. One of his Sfarim is a Sefer on the Simani Tara of grasshoppers, kosher grasshoppers, Karnei Chagavim it's called, whereas a study on the requirements, etc., kosher grasshoppers. And this involved a proper understanding of the different types of grasshoppers, etc. Now you understand that Reb Chaim was not, what do they call the bugologists? So there's a better word for it.
Entomologist.
Well, entomologist, that's right. So Reb Chaim was not that, right? And he was trying to piece together the information. I doubt that he ever touched a computer key. And there was one particular grasshopper that he was having a hard time understanding the technicalities of its physical structure, etc. And as he was struggling with it, a grasshopper entered through the window, landed right in front of him. And as he looked up and saw the grasshopper, he realized that this was the very grasshopper that he was trying to figure out, that he was trying to understand. And he studied it, and based on his study of this grasshopper, he was able to tie up the loose ends that he had in his sefer. That story, too, I've heard very creative. That story, as I just told it, was what I heard at the Levaya. I've also heard in the past from authoritative sources. There are very, very creative addenda to the story. All kinds of different, very interesting additions. Maybe not. But whatever the case is, they say that afterwards, Reb Chaim, they once had a fire in their house. And that afterwards, he was just very concerned to see that the tile where the grasshopper had landed was still there, because he felt that this was a special gilui of Siyata Dishmaya in his life. And there's a lot been said about that story. But I want to point out that a person who is not attuned isn't necessarily anything so special about that story. Grasshoppers enter people's houses, right? You could not necessarily, this is always framed as one of the Mythos stories of a kind, right? But for a person who is completely not attuned, they could actually experience such a thing and say, wow, what an amazing coincidence. What a fun person. I couldn't necessarily always see the divinity in the things that are happening in our lives. If we think about it in those terms, understand that you can look for a lot of siyata d'shmaya in your own life and find your own moifsim. But here's where I'm coming back to the point that the more you will be bringing Shekhinah into your life, the more you'll be connecting with the Shekhinah, you will see Hashem involved in your life. You'll see Hashem involved in your life. I doubt that you'll be able to bring people back to life. I doubt that you'll be able to predict when surgeries will be successful and when not. But you'll see Siyata D'Shmaya in your life. There's a spiritual dynamic in the Bria. Shamayim, Shekhinah is here. It's with us. It can be involved in our life. And here, Vaita, we have to be operating with open eyes. Hashem lately is mamish showing us. We've been talking about this for the last 2 years. But Hashem is showing us how He is here. And this is His world. And the world runs according to His rules. Reb Chaim was the man who for so many years was saying, missiles won't fall in Bnei Brak. Bnei Brak won't be harmed. Here, there, the various circumstances. And then there was always the question, the missile fell, was it actually, the only question of, was it a meter into Bnei Brak, was it a meter out of Bnei Brak? But in general, that was the way it played out. Reb Chaim was Nifta, and the first pigua ever happened in Bnei Brak. You have to be blind. You have to be deliberately blind not to see the effect here. We want to be living this. We want to be experiencing this. Not for the purpose of just saying, oh, look where we are now, but on the contrary, in order to really internalize the legacy and bring it into our lives. Now, if you know further, this tragic pigua, this tragic attack that happened in Bnei Brak, where Hashem is on the one hand showing us that realize that this is something very, very real. The koyach of the Torah, of the kedusha, of the dveikus b'Hashem, of the diktuk in halacha is something very, very real. And at the same time, note how Hashem showed this, where if you think statistically that in Bnei Brak there would be a pigua, and three of the five people who were, Rachman al-Itzlan, killed, were not Jewish. You can't fail to see the how Hashem is at work. See it, experience it. Don't be in the dark. Don't be left out of this. And how there were two other Jews, who this fellow who was apparently knew exactly what he was doing, apparently a very, very good marksman. How there were two other Jews who he came right up close to them and shot, and whatever it is, the gun didn't shoot. There were two other such Jews. One came out of his house, out of his building, and ran straight into the guy, right? The person aimed the gun right at him and just kept clicking. Wouldn't shoot. And there was another yeshiva bachur who was riding on a bike. This fellow chased him for a good few seconds, shooting at him, and the gun just clicked. It didn't shoot. Hashem is showing himself to us. Hashem is showing himself to us. And let's be attuned to it. Let's be attuned to really internalize the fact that, yes, bonding ourselves to Hashem, to His mitzvahs in a very meticulous way, as Avdei Hashem, living that dictum, right, of the Chafetz Chaim's son, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Goyzer HaTzadik Mekayim, we want to be that tzadik, and that would be the moifis of our life, and then to see the Siyata Dishmaya, That comes along with that. To be attuned to seeing Hashem operating in your life.
I have a question.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, question.
So, Rav Chaim was the son of the stifler, His uncle was a Hazanish. His father-in-law was Rav Eliashiv. Okay? So, and all of this generation is like sort of passed on. Who's going to be the new Rav Chaim? Like, you know, like it just feels like an era's gone by and he's going to step up because, as you said, we need that battle.
What is the future for Klal Yisrael after we've lost this glorious whole generation?
And, you know, like that generation.
That's the question.
Yeah.
So that's a tough question to address, of course. But I want to know two things. And then we'll declare our official 1:15 stopping point, and then I do want to continue for about another 15 minutes, green letter. First of all, don't worry about Hashem's plan for the world. Worry about how it's supposed to impact us. At the end of the day, well, there are a number of levels to this. But the whole story, as far as each of us individually are concerned, each of us is an Olam Umlaya. Bishvili Nivra Olam. The whole history of Yiddishkeit and all of the greatness surrounding us that we've been exposed to, in a sense, is about my own individual relationship with Hashem. Now, I'm going to make an egocentric statement here, but each of us should think in these egocentric terms. The story of Reb Chaim's life, on one level, was there as a lesson for my own personal individual world. Bishvili Nivra Oila means that every Jew is his own individual plan, and everything surrounding him is also including all of the history of the Bnei Yisrael leading up to him. Yitzias Mitzrayim, Maral tells us, Hashem did it, not just for Klal Yisrael in general, but Hashem was picturing each individual neshama of eternity, me, and you. And Hashem said, I am doing this whole process for you, because I want to have this in place, and then I will need, for you, another couple of thousand years in the interim to really set the stage for your appearance, and then I want you to live this very, very individual story of you and me with all of that background, with the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim, with the whole story of Nach that followed it, with the influence of Ravina and Rav Ashi, and of Rashi and the Ramban, and of the Shulchan Aruch, the base of Karo, and the Gra, and Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Harav Avadi Yosef, and of Reb Chaim Kanievsky. All that was put in place in order to impact your individual relationship with me. Take all that and invest it into your relationship with me. And then you will have made all this into a success. That's really the answer as far as each of us individually goes, and that really deserves a lot more elaboration. But that's number one. Number two to realize is Hashem provides greatness as is needed for each generation. In every generation, they were able to look back and say, it's just not what it was. The glorious era of the past, right? The people in the Chafetz Chaim's time, and we would think, Chafetz Chaim, Reb Chaim Oizer, Reb Chaim Brisker, what was there greater than that? They looked back and they said, the days of Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, right? And Rabbi Akiva Eiger, right? What do we have today? So, look out for the greatness that exists today. We have greatness today. If we lost something that we don't know if we can ever replace that void, so draw whatever you can off that into your own individual system. But look around for the greatness today. There is. And we can make use of it. But really answer the question? I haven't really answered the question. I don't know if it really can be answered. But that's a practical way to approach it. Okay, now from here, okay, as I said, now really feel comfortable to leave. We're going to go for a blee nether about another 15 minutes, not more than that, but feel comfortable to step out. I'm going to wait a minute. Okay, you're too shy to take me up. Okay. We move from here into the Pesach season. Pesach season, really, and here's what I want to say. Let's not walk around just with a sense of what we had is gone. There's a void. Look at how, and it's just going from here, it's just downward. On the contrary, I think that the way we've been trying to discuss it is Let's take that legacy and put it into our own lives at our little level, at our little level. And if we can do that, it's a major accomplishment. That's greatness. Moving into the period of Pesach, which is the Jewish people moving into their very, very great role as the Am Hashem. And right now, I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about, not Pesach itself, but the time that we have from now till Pesach. We know there, I hope in the evenings, to have a couple of shiurim on Pesach, which we'll make available on Zoom, and also the recordings that we know there. But right now, I want to spend a few minutes talking about what's happening up till then. Coming back to Reb Chaim made a statement. Somebody asked him, and it says, I'm not going to get into the precise halachic ins and outs, but somebody asked him about a certain halachic point where the Mishnah Berurah says, you're allowed to do this really, but might be better to do it that way. And if you can do it in a way that brings together the various considerations, meaning if you can kind of do it in a way that makes everything work, right? Meaning, there's a chumrah, but that chumrah has a certain downside, and therefore might actually be better not to utilize a chumrah. But then he suggests kind of like something in the a way of doing it very specifically. And he says, if you can do it that way, which satisfies all the different considerations, kadosh ye'amer loy, we would deem you a kadosh. That's the lashon of the Mishnah Berurah. So somebody asked Reb Chaim, why does this detail make you into a kadosh? It's something almost technical. And Reb Chaim Kanievsky said, the basic obligation of the Jew is to live Shulchan Aruch. And he said, and the Jew who can live Shulchan Aruch behidur, in an enhanced way, in the best way possible, that's a kaddish. Now, there's a lot to that statement, and I want to talk about it a little bit in a very practical perspective of what we're going to be busy with these next couple of weeks. On the one hand, Yiddishkeit is very much about pnimius. It's about chodesh halvavos. It's about our emunah, our inner connection with Hashem. On the other hand, Yiddishkeit is very, very much about chitzonius. It's very, very much about physical actions with a lot of detail. And doing it exactly this way and not that way, even though you have no idea what is the meaning of it. Why is this meaningful, right? Detail, detail, detail. And particularly when we're talking about preparing for Pesach, right? A lot of physical activity, you might think, wouldn't it be better to really just meditate, focus on the truths of it, etc. And the answer to that is, and here also I'm quickly moving through concepts that really all deserve greater elaboration, that whether we like it or not, we are physical people. We're flesh and blood. Flesh and blood, whether you like it or not, is a complicated business. And if you try to think that I just want to be focused on the inner experiences of things and the inner realities and inner truths, your flesh and blood gets in the way, mixes things up, right? And when you're feeling very, very holy, your flesh and blood suddenly comes and says, yeah, but I want a meal right now, right? And you can't get away from that. It makes you tired, makes you cranky, it confuses things in terms of what I want now. Is it really because I'm focused on the right thing, or is it my ego getting in the way? Therefore, we want to be developing our pnimius. While the truth is that what's really going to shape who we are very, very much has to do about with our chitzonius, with taking our flesh and blood and beating it into a system of avodas Hashem, disciplining it, making it work according to Hashem's directives, etc. And this very, very much is the great value of Tiktuk Halacha as a concept in general. Without getting into the particulars, Tiktuk Halacha is an area that so often is not appreciated. I want to just focus on the beauty of Shabbos, on the concept of Shabbos, and then you get into all the particulars of Kli Rishon and Kli Sheni and Boyer and Muktzah and all these. And why do we need all that just getting in the way of the beautiful experience of what Shabbos is meant to be? And the answer is it becomes much, much more real if you really have to dedicate yourself to it by putting yourself through the grind. That really connects in. If you can connect that to the pneumistic experiences, you will be emerging as the top quality Jew. Whereas if you only want to operate with the inner experiences, you would really have to set up without a body. Because whether you like it or not, the body will get in the way. And therefore, Hashem says, I'm going to give you a whole complicated regimen of mitzvahs to really bring out your fullest greatness by banging your flesh and blood body into my avoda as a disciplined Eved Hashem. And that, in a very broad way, is the value, if we're just talking about the Hashkafic concept of Dipduk Halacha, which seems something like it's completely detached from all the beautiful things we like to be focused on. No, it's not. It's what creates the disciplined, real disciplined Eved Hashem, the soldier of Hashem, who is capable of doing His will, available at His beck and call, whatever He might demand at any given moment. And it challenges us on all sides. It challenges our tavas achila, it challenges our pride, it challenges, because Hashem says, I want all these different faculties of yours banged into my service. And you're not going to get all these faculties banged into Hashem's service unless you're putting them through a rigorous regimen of masim, 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 of external acts, which bang them into that shape. The Ruchel Movavitz question. Oh. Very good application, beautiful application. Sefer HaChinuch on Pesach, on the Korban Pesach, where he says, Achrei HaPu'ulos Nimshachem HaLevavos. The Levavos, the inside, is going to be very, very greatly affected by the external things that we do. That's why, right? Yiddishkeit Yashakach, for bringing that up, but you might have thrown me onto a tangent. That's why, right, so many Maasei Chesed that the Torah demands on us. It doesn't just say, you know, be a sensitive person. It imposes all, so many of the mitzvahs are there to bang sensitivity into us from the outside, right? So now, Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz's question.
Now here's the question. So as women, I don't know that we know halakha versus tumra. Like you take Pesach cleaning, like it could be a freak out because you could read one sefer where it tells you you have to do 3 billion different things, and then you could read another sefer where it says it shouldn't be onerous, you don't have to do A, B, C, or D. Like you add a lot of chumras, you might turn it into something very distasteful and onerous.
Right.
And kill the heart on the inside.
Oh, so the question is, where do we draw the balance? We're talking about the example of Pesach specifically. Between going overboard, really completely running yourself into the ground, and you're getting different messages in terms of the chumras and in terms of not overdoing it, that really deserves a lot of discussion. It deserves discussion in itself, and you know what? Maybe I'll actually dedicate, right now I'm going to continue just with the general concept, I would like to dedicate time to that. Maybe in one of our evening 20-minute shiurim, we'll address that at length. What I'll say in a general way right now, just for our purposes, is I'll draw out a very, very broad guideline. That is that I'm going to give you the very unhelpful solution that you need to find the balance. There, I've solved the problem. But the idea being, on the one hand, you want to be appreciating the rigorous work, while on the other hand, drawing the line between that and doing it overboard, basically repeating what you said, to the extent that it really turns into
beyond halakha. And I think for women, it's often very unclear what is the actual halakhic line.
So I'm gonna
hear all right. sorts of things, but we don't really know.
So yeah, I right now all I'll say is there are very good shiurim about that. There are very good shiurim about that. You have to hear a contemporary shiur from a rav who you know, who will be able to convey both values, the value of the working hard. They are very good shiur. We can talk about that, Lina, that maybe I could. I think that there's going to be a shiur from Rav David this week. But that deserves more attention. Right now, I just want to spend a couple of minutes weiter on the general concept. Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz has a very beautiful piece where he talks about the uniqueness of the mitzvahs leading up to Pesach, namely, ridding your house of chametz and making matzahs. And I'm not talking about the time of the Korban Pesach, etc. I'm talking about today's experience. Living in your house of chametz and making matzahs. He says, we don't find such a phenomenon of a single iser that involves so much effort to avoid it. Right? And we put in so much effort. Really, in many senses, many of the mitzvahs of Pesach are reflective and representative of the system in general. But what we're busy doing now is, as he said, we're putting in a lot of effort, rigorous efforts, to make sure that that one command of Hashem is being done right. It's all this effort to avoid an issur. And when it comes to matzahs, whether you like it or not, is set up such that you have to be very energetic and meticulous at the same time about making the matzahs. So Rabbi Ruchem says, and you know what? This might be something that what might otherwise feel onerous can give a lot of fulfillment. When he says that, appreciate how all those efforts into ridding your house of chametz, so that when the time Pesach comes, you can say, Hashem said, there is no chametz in my house. All those efforts are a very, very great exercise. It's really representative of what we're doing all the time in applying ourselves to being able to say, Hashem, you gave me a command. I cherish it to an extent that I'm going to turn myself upside down to make sure that I can come back to you afterwards and say, here it is in perfect form. And he says, you cannot comprehend what that is doing for the nefesh of the Jew. He says that I should really have bought the sefer and read his full paragraph, his concluding paragraph out. But he says that the zikuch and the tihur of what that process does for the nefesh of the Jew is unimaginable. And he says, when you have a Jew who's standing on Erev Pesach afternoon, the Erev Pesach Jew, he calls it, who's been through this process, and he has his matzahs on the table, and his home is rid of chametz, he says, Ein kol bria yichol lamoy b'mchitzasai. The Jew at that Erev Pesach Jew is in a realm that no other being can approach. It's the amazing state that you are in, that you've put yourself through, by loading yourself down with massive external actions, rigorous energy and activity in dedication to fulfilling Ratzon Hashem. And where that brings your nefesh to, where the state that it puts you in, when you're actually ready for the Leil HaSeder and moving into it, is something that, again, as his lashon is, the Erev Pesach Jew, Ein kol bria yichol lamoy b'mchitzasai. You're in a sphere that no other being can approach. Deserves more elaboration, like we kept on saying. I would bli nedar try to, like I said, maybe dedicate one of the evening shiurim, and I'll notify about it beforehand, bli nedar, about your particular question. But right now, let's just approach these next coming weeks with that realization. We move in Pesach, we're moving into a pristine world where it's just Hashem and us, where we are being crowned with that glorious title of B'nai Kel Chai. And the weeks that are leading up to it are an end in and of itself of putting ourselves through that purification process of being able to come to Him presentable for that role. And as we said, it's really reflective of the way the system works in general. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you.